This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
And this is James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com, and we welcome you back to another jam-packed episode of New World Next Week, which, of course, you can find all the episodes, high-quality, low-quality, audio-only, and more on NewWorldNextWeek.com. James, so very much to get into, so very much to try and follow in the news. And we'll begin with the story that I thought was going to fly under the radar as the whole Casey Anthony distraction played out here in the States, and I guess it probably played out internationally. A story that has similar elements has emerged and now is becoming a huge story here in the States and beyond. And I have it posted on cyberspacewar.com. Murdoch tabloid under fire after hacking into murder victims' phones. Police officers investigating phone hacking by the News of the World are turning their attention to examine every high-profile case involving the murder, abduction, or attack on any child since 2001 in response to the revelation that journalists from the tabloid newspaper News of the World hacked into the voicemail messages of murdered schoolgirl in the UK, Millie Dowler. The move is a direct response to The Guardian's exclusive story this past Monday that a private investigator working for the News International tabloid named Glenn Mulcair interfered with police, The move is a direct response to The Guardian's exclusive story on Monday that a private investigator working for the News International tabloid, Glenn Mulcair, caused Millie's parents to wrongly believe she was still alive and interfered with police inquiries into her disappearance by hacking into the teenager's mobile phone and deleting messages. News of the impending police action capped a dramatic day yesterday of unfolding developments, and I provide the links for you as The Guardian and other newspapers are following this quite closely now. And again, this story is now on the front of Google News, which is that arbiter of the most important things in the world, of course, still falling after the Casey Anthony story. James, an interesting related bit to this, as there are so many, and as I speak to you now on Wednesday, July 6th here in the States, this is one of those stories that's developing rapidly, so I will implore you guys to go do more research for yourself. But an interesting related bit to this from The Guardian: even families of 7/7 victims were targets of phone hacking. The phone hacking crisis enveloping the News of the World intensified on Tuesday night after it emerged that Scotland Yard has started to contact the relatives of the victims of the July 7th, 2005 attacks to warn them they were targeted by the paper. The revelation that bereaved family members may have had their mobile phone messages intercepted by Glenn Mulcair, a private investigator employed by the paper, in the days following the 2005 London bombings, will heap further pressure on the title's owner, News International, part of Rupert Murdoch's media empire. And this story, of course, goes on and on. And, of course, we must mention that we're now at yet another anniversary of the false flag event known as the London 7/7 bombings. James.
Absolutely right. This is an incredible story. There's so many different aspects to this that I'd like to get into. Not only the unbelievable idea of hacking into people's phones as part of the journalistic endeavor, but with the 7/7 story, I noticed that the BBC had talked to Graham Foulkes, who, if I remember correctly, is the man that that the Telegraph and other pieces were talking to about the recent revelations about the supposed 7/7 mastermind terrorist ringleader trainer, who actually also happened to be working for the U.S. government. So that was interesting to hear him. And basically, he wants to talk to Rupert Murdoch directly about the practices of his News International and the way that they're collecting data on this. But I mean, just so many disgusting, horrific, horrendous things going on here. And it brings up so many questions, but another one of the questions that it brings up is this mobile phone technology that we've all got carrying around in our pockets and that is taking up more and more of our lives and more of our data is being stored on it. And again, we keep seeing things like this where it's, in this technological age, it's so easy to get a hold of all our details and to put them on the web and to publish them and to intercept them and to hack them and all of this stuff. So again, we're just getting ensnared in this web, and it's a pretty horrific thing. And I'm glad that this story is picking up and growing legs, because it's something that people have to stand up to now while we have the chance.
And James, you and I, for now the last probably 2 years, have been discussing on this show and our own respective shows this idea of the coming sort of I-9-11, and over these last several weeks and months, as we see these hack attacks grow and grow and grow, there's obviously a larger agenda at play. But let's now move to our second story. And speaking of revelations, we will take this from biggovernment.com. FBI official to federal judge, OKC bombing videotapes might have been misfiled, impossible to know where. In a response filed yesterday to a federal judge's order May 11th, an FBI official offered no denials about the existence of video images captured by more than 20 surveillance cameras operating prior to 9:02 a.m. on April 19, 1995, in the vicinity of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in downtown Oklahoma City. Instead, he explained that officials at the Bureau merely cannot find the tapes and raised the possibility that they might have been misfiled and thus could be located somewhere other than in the OK bomb file, though it would be impossible to know where. The order, issued by Judge Clark Wadoop in the U.S. District Court for the District of Utah, Central Division, stemmed from the Bureau's failure to comply with a three-year-old FOIA request submitted by Salt Lake City lawyer Jesse Trinidou, a man on a quest for answers related to the OKC bombing and the death of his brother, Kenneth Trinidou, who died under suspicious circumstances several months later while in custody at the U.S. Bureau of Prisons in Oklahoma City. Judge Wadoop's order was both clear and concise. The items to which the FBI was to respond by June 30th and how the Bureau responded are in these 5 points that I'll hit for you briefly before, James, I throw it to you and you can really expand on this story for us. Number one, affirm whether the six government officials from the FBI and CIA who had submitted affidavits in this case had misrepresented information or provided incomplete or otherwise misleading information to the court. Number two, advise whether the iDrive and S-Drive data storage areas on the FBI computer system were searched for the videotapes and other documents sought by my FOIA request, and if not, why not? Number three, state whether the evidence control centers or other evidence storage facilities located at FBI headquarters, the FBI Crime Lab, and FBI Oklahoma City Field Office were manually searched for the videotapes and other requested materials, and if not, explain why such searches were not done. Number four, manually search the OK bomb physical files at FBI headquarters, the FBI Crime Lab, and the FBI Oklahoma City Field Office for the videotapes and other requested documents or provide evidence as to why such a search would be too burdensome. And number five, provide the court with an affidavit from Mr. Hardy stating that he does not know of either the existence of or the likely locations of the videotapes and that he is unaware of anyone else that may know of the existence or likely locations of the videotapes. In an email this morning, Jesse Trinidou pointed out to biggovernment.com things about the FBI's response as being noteworthy, such as there's no affidavit from someone within the FBI stating that the tapes do not exist. James, please flesh out this story for us.
All right. Well, the basic idea of this story is that the FBI and the mainstream media and all of that is going to spin this story as, well, the FBI says that the tapes are probably not there. They probably don't exist and they probably won't be able to ever find them. So, you know, case closed. But the real point here, and something that Jesse pointed out in that email to Big Government and in emails to me, I've read through the court filings. The real point is that they will not have their agent declare in an affidavit to the court that the tapes do not exist, whereas Jesse has filed two affidavits from two different people, a retired Oklahoma City police officer and someone who worked for a security company, both of whom saw the way that the Alfred P. Murrah camera footage was being stored off-site. It was being recorded in an off-site location a couple of blocks away from the building, so it would not have been destroyed in the blast. And also an affidavit from one of those individuals talked about the way that FBI agents were there on the scene on April 19th, removing the cameras from the building. So again, they're knee deep in all of this. And the point is that the mainstream media and the FBI are going to spin this to say that the tapes just probably don't exist. You're probably just making all of this up. Whereas the real point is they will not go on record to the court and say that point blank. So again, Jesse's doing incredible work uncovering all of this, and people have got to get back behind what he's doing and raise up a stink about this story because it needs more coverage.
And it does, you know, it makes me wonder if we will see a huge, you know, break in this case, maybe even more so than we'll see sooner than the 9/11 10th anniversary. And another thing, James, that we kind of briefly mentioned before we started to roll here is that this kind of reminds me of something Aidan Monahan said in an interview that you conducted with him and all the amazing FOIA work he's done related to 9/11 is this sort of way you have to correctly formulate your FOIA request. that if you formulate the question wrong, they'll go, oh, no, sorry. You just, you know, it's one of those, oh, Simon didn't say, so now we're not going to respond. So it's this game of trying to correctly formulate and ask the question in the precise way that they can't wiggle out of it. So this is interesting that these guys, they basically don't want to perjure themselves.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. Unfortunately, that's exactly right. I'm not so optimistic that the FBI is ever going to come and say, oh, here's the tape. You know, here's the one that shows John Doe number two. Here's the one that shows the whole explosion. They're never going to come out with that. But the point is that they are engaged in this cover-up of the existence of the tapes, let alone what's on the tapes, let alone where to find the tapes. It might have been misfiled. Yeah, right, exactly. The most important evidence and the most important trial in American history to that point, with the biggest FBI investigation in history to that point, they just misfiled the evidence. Yeah, right.
So this, again, plays into the idea that a lot of folks like to kind of believe in, and that's, oh, they're just incompetent. They could never pull off anything this large. See how silly and stupid they are, and we'll just kind of buy that story. I believe one of the other things they're trying to get out is also the dash cam recording of the arrest of McVeigh.
Yeah, he got a recording, but it seems to be edited. He's looking for the original unedited tape, and they're saying that he's got it. So again, they're pulling the same type of stuff with that as well.
Interesting. So, James, for our third and final story, I guess we'll stay on the corruption of Hoover's FBI and take it from the Telegraph. Ernest Hemingway driven to suicide over FBI surveillance. A. E. Hotchner said he believed the FBI's monitoring of the Nobel Prize-winning author over suspicions of his links to Cuba substantially contributed to his anguish and his suicide 50 years ago. Hotchner wrote in the New York Times that he had regretfully misjudged his friend's fears of federal investigators, which were dismissed as paranoid delusions for years after his death. In 1983, the FBI released a 127-page file it had kept on Ernest Hemingway since the 1940s, confirming he was watched by agents working for J. Edgar Hoover, who took a personal interest in his case. Hotchner described being met off a train by Hemingway in Ketchum, Idaho in November 1960 for a pheasant shoot with their friend Duke McMullen. Hemingway, struggling to complete his last work, complained the feds had tailed us all the way and that agents were poring over his accounts in a local bank and that they passed on their journey. It's the worst hell, Hemingway said. The goddamnedest hell. They've bugged everything. That's why we're using Duke's car. Mine's bugged. They've bugged everything. Everything. Can't use the phone. Mail intercepted. Later that month, he was committed for psychiatric care at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, where he received electric shock treatment. He attempted suicide several times before being released. A few days after returning home to Ketchum, he shot himself in the head with his favorite shotgun at the age of 61. In the years since, I have tried to reconcile Ernest's fear of the FBI, which I regretfully misjudged, with the reality of the FBI file, wrote Hotchner, the author of Papa Hemingway. I now believe he truly sensed the surveillance and that it substantially contributed to his anguish and his suicide. James?
Well, just another example of another person who was driven to absolute despair by the types of tricks by the dark actors playing games. You could think back to John Lennon, who also was called a crazy, kooky conspiracy theorist for the idea that he was being watched by the FBI and he was having his phone tapped. But again, once the file came out, it turned out, yes, that was exactly the case. So here we have Ernest Hemingway, who was complaining about this and was called a crazy, kooky conspiracy theorist, committed to an insane asylum, given electroshock therapy. And again, it comes out. He was exactly right. They were doing all of this to him. So so this type of thing happens over and over, and you can look to people like Lennon and Hemingway for examples of this, or you can look to things like Gary Webb, who was talking about strange things going on at his house and strange men coming in the middle of the night and things like that shortly before he killed himself by shooting himself twice in the head, or David Kelly, who made an email about dark actors playing games just a couple of hours before he slit his own wrist on Harrow Down Hill. So again, this happens time and again. People are persecuted and hounded by various agencies, and then years later, when the truth finally comes out, it's quietly admitted in a little story like this. So again, if we don't raise a bloody murder about these types of stories, no one's going to. So let's continue spreading the truth about things like this.
James, just under 30 seconds left, but I want to end it on a bright note and mention that Ernest Hemingway plays a fairly prominent role in the fantastic new Woody Allen film Midnight in Paris. So if folks are looking for a way to beat the heat and hide in a theater, Midnight in Paris is fantastic. So thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, James.